This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report, and I'm coming to you on this fifth day of March 2011 with my guest Keelan Balderson of Wideshut.co.uk, a website with news articles, radio shows, and video content covering the major stories from the UK and overseas. Keelan is the freelance blogger, radio host, and documentary filmmaker behind the meticulously researched online documentary 7-7 The Big Picture, and he hosts Resistance Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Keelan Balderson, thank you so much for joining us today on the Corbett Report.
Thanks for having me, James. It's an honor.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, especially just the considering the incredible work you've been doing on 7-7 and many other issues as well. So since this is your first voyage on the Corbett Report, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about yourself and about Wideshut.co.uk.
Well, I started that a couple of years ago now. I update it weekly with alternative news coverage, mainly from a UK perspective. I think we're a bit underrepresented in the wider truth community. So, you know, I try and fill those gaps. The nerve center of my operation is in a converted shed. And on my radio show, we call that the freezing shed of truth. I do that on the Resistance Radio Network. Quite a number of good hosts on there. We have shows every day. So, yeah, I'm just, you know, one guy trying to get an alternative view out there.
Well, exactly like myself. And I think it's a lot of one-man operations like that working together that will ultimately make a difference. And certainly the work you've been doing is quite interesting. And I do suggest people check it out at wideshut.co.uk. But today I wanted to have you on specifically to talk about 7-7 and some of the remarkable things that have been happening in developments related on to that in recent weeks and months, including, of course, the incredible story that's come out recently that The Guardian reported on in mid-February about Mohammed Junaid Babar and his relation to the 7-7 bombers and what's been happening with his court case. So perhaps you can fill us in not only on what the recent development is, but sort of the broader context of that story.
Basically, this Babar character served only, you know, a few years of a possible 70-year sentence. You know, some people are in Guantanamo Bay for less than that, so it's suspicious right away. But there was suspicions of Babar going back to, you know, all the way back to people's first investigations of 9/11, because the attacks, oddly, his mother was actually in the towers. But he came out all over the media talking about how he's going to go to Afghanistan, how he's going to kill Americans. He was actually brought up in America. And there's literally these video interviews of him, I believe with CNN and ITN here in Britain. And unless he's, you know, a complete moron or was just fantasizing, what kind of real hardline terrorist is going to parade about on TV, getting himself on a terror watch list straight away? And it just seems a bit odd. The only people that really gained from that situation were the neocons and the warmongers looking to promote the war on terror, because he said exactly what he needed them to say. But suspicions aside, he basically did fly out to Pakistan. He's documented making different contacts, setting up terror training camps. He flies to and from Britain freely, because Britain at that time actually allowed terrorists to operate. We can get to that policy later. But in Britain, he joined the Al-Muhajirun network. He gets involved with what would become the fertilizer bomb plot, which was foiled under Operation Crevice in 2004. And while these Crevice arrests are being made, this big bust on this you know, this conspiracy to bomb a shopping center and a nightclub, he happily flies back to America, where he's a known wanted terrorist and is soon picked up by the security services, which again is a rather strange thing to do, considering he was a wanted terrorist. And then, of course, as we now know, he immediately jumps ship and begins working for the FBI and intelligence. And even mainline news, BBC, London Times, suggested that he was probably working with the FBI all along, not just when they claim to have turned him, but also, as I discussed in my film and is now more concrete with these court documents, that it was on record that Babar was cooperating before his arrest, which could have been during the fertilizer plot itself. It could have gone all the way back to the terror training camp that Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the 7/7 bomber, attended. So it's a really bizarre story.
Bizarre, I suppose, is one word for it, and shocking is another, especially for the people who have lost loved ones in the 7/7 bombings. It's quite outrageous that this man is now going free. But as you say, there has been a lot of this type of activity going on in the UK for quite a while now. And for people who don't remember what Operation Crevice was or what that was all about, perhaps you could fill us in on that as well.
Right, yeah. Well, Operation Crevice was a big surveillance operation in the UK, monitoring different would-be terrorists, Mohammed Sadiq Khan and Shehzad Tanweer, the suspected 7/7 bombers, were on the periphery of that investigation, and there's all sorts of questions as to whether the security services really did know that they, you know, were up to some things or not. And the trial of Operation Crevice is probably more important than the operation itself, because we come to more of these intelligence assets and a bigger picture sort of becomes clear. We have this guy, Mohammed Qayyum Khan, who was known as Q. And Q was involved in this fertilizer bomb trial under Operation Crevice. In fact, at times, he was considered the mastermind of the whole thing. He was a leading Al-Qaeda member in Britain. He had admittedly funded terrorism overseas. And somebody called Omar Khayyam ultimately went down as the leader of the plot. And he claimed to have received funding from this Q character. And also, what recently was repeated in the inquest was that 7/7 bomber Mohammed Sadiq Khan had also been in contact with this Q character. There are phone call records and such. And so what's most interesting that I found out of this is that Q was said to be instrumental in sending Mohammed Sadiq Khan to the terror training camp in Pakistan, which, as we now know, was ran by Mohammed Junaid Babar, who was likely working for American intelligence at the time, or that's a strong possibility. Now, it gets more interesting because Junaid Babar, who was associates with all these Crevice characters, who flew right out of the country as all of this was unfolding into the hands of US officials, after the plot was foiled and, you know, everything was put to trial, he's flown back and given immunity to testify against all of these men. And funnily enough, the only two people that walked away from that trial free were Q, who is believed to have sent Mohammed Sadiq Khan to Babar's camp, and Babar himself, who, you know, has later been suggested, and as we now know, was working for the intelligence agencies. So it's just amazing that this kind of stuff can go on, and he's not the only one. I mean, we can go on a bit further.
Please do. Well, who are some of the other people who have some of these intelligence asset type of backgrounds?
Well, there's this other guy called Haroon Rashid Aswat, and when Mohammed Sadiq Khan gets back from Babar's terror training camp, he then comes in contact with this Aswat guy. And he's again thought to be a leading member of Al-Qaeda in Britain. He even said himself that he was once a bodyguard to bin Laden. He did the whole terror training thing in the mid-90s. He was observed recruiting young men in the infamous Finsbury Park Mosque with a guy called Abu Hamza. And Aswat's big claim to fame is that he was trying to set up a terror training camp in the US, in Oregon, at one point. But when it came to indicting him for that operation, high up US officials blocked it from going ahead. And this is around 2002. But if we skip ahead a bit, in the days leading up to the London attacks, Mohammed Sadiq Khan was in phone contact with ASWAT. It was widely reported that there were 20 or so phone calls, you know, these phone call records, and that ASWAT was the mastermind behind the 7/7 attacks. It was the big headlines for about a week. And then a few weeks after that, the story was suddenly true. There's no mastermind. There's no connection to Al-Qaeda. There's no wider network. These were homegrown radicals that just decided to do it one day. And that's a really odd thing to happen. Like, sources talk to the newspapers, and all of a sudden it's wrong. And what ultimately happened was U.S. federal prosecutor and terrorist expert John Loftus comes out on Fox News and says that ASWAT was British intelligence all along. And then French intelligence, in some articles with the New Criminologist, they also said the same thing. So presumably, that's why he wasn't indicted on the Oregon training camp thing to begin with. And I guess why the story suddenly dropped that he was the mastermind, that they no longer reported that. Because it's highly likely that he was another intelligence asset. And it brings up so many questions about MI5 and the CIA and their relation to terrorism. Because at every critical point, Mohammed Sadiq Khan seems to be in contact with these dubious characters. You know, he's sent to a terror training camp by a suspected asset. He's trained by a suspected asset. And then when he gets back, he's instructed by another suspected asset. It's quite unbelievable.
Unbelievable is one word for it. It certainly does paint a very specific picture of what was going on that's quite different than what I think has filtered down through the corporate-controlled media. And I think that absolutely brings us to the question of the greater understanding of what was happening on the day of 7/7 itself, something that you went into in great detail in 7/7, The Big Picture. So let's start talking about the four suspected bombers and what their suspected role was, and then what can actually be proven from the documents and records.
Well, the official story, the first narrative that was produced to the public in 2006. It was very non-specific, lots of ifs and buts. Instead of, you know, showing as evidence, they said things like, oh, they must have got this certain train, they must have done that. And you know, you say, well, based on what? And, you know, one of the early errors that was picked out by independent researchers was that the train they supposedly got from Luton to King's Cross wasn't even running that day, so they had to go back and say, well, probably it was this train that they got. And that's not a major point of worry. I mean, they were actually in London that day. There is now quite a lot of CCTV footage that show them in London that day. It is a bit murky because some of it that was released sort of blurred out the timestamps. So you can independently verify what some of the times were. And that can get a little bit nitpicky if you go down that route. I think I was a victim of that in my film. But for me, the main problem with the CCTV is that there isn't any of the alleged bombers boarding or on their targets. So there isn't any from the platforms standing waiting for their trains. And there isn't any from inside the trains that survived the blast, or there just wasn't any running at all. Sorry, I just got a call come up there. I just cancelled it. But as I was saying, no CCTV on their targets or, you know, waiting for them. And on the number 30 bus as well, the official story says there was no CCTV working on the bus that day, which is possible, you know, these things happen. But then it also goes on to say Hasib Hussein, the youngest of the bombers, got onto the number 91 bus traveling from King's Cross to Euston Station and then he switched to the number 30 bus. But there's no CCTV to verify that either. There's two buses with no CCTV. And InfoWars came out with a comment from somebody from Stagecoach who said that, you know, we check CCTV two or three times a week. It should have been running, and to have two buses, it's just another one of those things you can add to the list. That's a bit.
I believe, in fact, one of the detective inspectors just recently clarified during the inquests that apparently he can't even remember why the number 91 bus. He can't even remember why the footage was not available from that, and then the number 30 right. bus supposedly was malfunctioning, so that's why it had not recorded anything since the previous year. But as you just pointed out, that's a highly unlikely scenario.
Yeah, and with a lot of these high-profile events, you always get the CCTV at the most important point didn't seem to be working.
Yeah, funny how that happens. And in fact, that's the exact topic of a video that I'll be releasing later this week, so people should stay tuned for more on that. But absolutely, it happens in time after time in all of these very key large-scale terror attacks and bombings.
I guess we could move on to some other things. DNA evidence, that's quite an important thing. And to begin with, there wasn't really any official statements about the DNA. In my film, when I did it, there wasn't really anything I could find to sort of corroborate that there was DNA. There is now some information that came out in the inquest, but there's still some dubious things about it. Mohammed Sadiq Khan's DNA was said to have been derived from a single muscle sample from the few remains that were left, because Khan and Tanweer were said to be nearly completely disintegrated in the explosions. But they took this sample and then cross-referenced it with his parents' DNA, and some have said, well, maybe that's a bit odd. Why don't they didn't they get something from Khan's home, like a hair or something that would connect it exactly? So it's not clear why they chose his parents. And interestingly, J7, the July 7th Truth Campaign, July7th.co.uk, they pointed out that some media articles, including The Independent, which is a mainstream paper over here, they reported that Khan's real mother had died, and that he was living with a stepmother. So basically, the lady named on this DNA sample wasn't even his birth mother, which means it couldn't have been matched. So somebody somewhere has got their wires crossed, whether that's the media or the people presenting this DNA evidence. It's not clear, but it would be nice to have that clarified. There's also Tanweer's DNA was said to have been taken from part of a spinal bone, which was basically all that was left of his body beyond the odd sort of bits and pieces. And this was said to have been cross-referenced with DNA from a public order offence in 2004, which is fair enough. And but I can't find anything concrete on Hasib Hussein. Maybe it's buried somewhere in the transcripts. There is a lot of these transcripts that I haven't seen. But what seems to be the main evidence for him is this phone they found somewhere at Tavistock Square near the bus bombing that has his fingerprints on it. And then there was a bag, at the supposed bomb factory that contained some kind of holder for the phone that had his fingerprints on it also, and they made the connection that way. But maybe the most odd DNA story is the one of Jermaine Lindsay, because the official government narrative says Lindsay's car was towed away from Luton Station car park because it didn't have a parking ticket. Yet when the media came out and reported that they found his DNA, they reported that it came from the pay and display ticket that he put on his car. But the official narrative says his car is towed away because it didn't have a ticket. And the bizarre twist to that makes it even more confusing is Luton Station's own policy isn't to tow cars away if they don't have a ticket. So we really don't know why his car was towed away either. So that's a, another sort of confusing aspect of the story.
Absolutely, yeah. Just another thing that doesn't add up, and there are so many of those. Absolutely, and then of course we also have the testimony of Richard Jones, which is used to place Hasib Hussein on the number 30 bus.
Right, yeah, Richard Jones. Basically, every other media appearance that he had, he contradicted the previous media appearance. I mean, and the BBC in their quote unquote debunking documentary on 7/7, you know, they proudly positioned Richard Jones up there as an eyewitness that saw Hussein, and that all these evil conspiracy theorists saying that he was in on the attack and stuff. Of course, no credible researcher is saying that Richard Jones blew up the bus or anything like that. It was kind of a straw man argument, but they never actually called him on his contradictory statements. And basically he was saying things like, I saw Hasib Hussein wearing a brown jumper and checkered trousers, and then it was, you know, a different color, and then it was a bigger bag, then it was a smaller bag. And the CCTV that was released of Hussein in London show that he was quite clearly wearing blue, so you can't really take Richard Jones' testimony very seriously.
Certainly an unreliable witness, but one that conveniently makes the prosecution's case for it. Not that there has ever been a proper prosecution, of course. Absolutely. Well, yeah. Other aspects of 7/7 that you think are important to concentrate on?
Well, yeah, the identification of the bombers on their alleged targets comes from, other than this DNA, which some of it is not really conclusive unless they come out and, you know, fully transparent with how they obtained it, but they found IDs at each of the scenes, but they say they were scattered far enough away so as not to be seriously damaged and destroy the evidence, basically. And the BBC said that, oh, this is because the bombers wanted to be identified, which is possible, but I'm not sure how easy it is to scatter ID around on a packed train without being noticed. I mean, did they manage to drop these things when they were entering? These are packed tube trains. It'd be difficult to barge past people and drop your ID in one area and then move to another part of the carriage, at least without people noticing. I mean, if I saw somebody drop a driver's license, I'd be like, excuse me, sir, you've dropped your driver's license. You'd think things like that would be coming out in eyewitness statements if they drop these things everywhere. For Jermaine Lindsay, they found a driver's license, a passport, a mobile phone insurance document, a mobile phone itself, a Department of Work and Pensions letter. I mean, was he standing there like emptying his bag in the middle of the carriage or what? And the official narrative even says that documents belonging to Khan were found at three different locations. They discovered Tanweer's wallet at Aldgate with a number of his cards in it, and then one that named Khan, and then there was some on Khan's own target train. And then on the number 30 bus, there was another like credit card that belonged to Mohammed Sadiq Khan. And that was found on the lower deck when the explosion was on the top deck. So maybe it sort of exploded downwards. It's not really clear, but or maybe Hussein sort of threw it as he was entering the bus, barging past people before he got to the top deck. I mean, it's hard to comprehend truly how that was all done.
Reminiscent of the magical passports on 9/11, I suppose. Well, absolutely. Well, how about the identification of the explosives that were actually used? Or has that ever actually been finalized?
That's a big point. The official narrative states that the explosives were cooked up in this bomb factory, you know, in Leeds, and that it was all homemade material. You know, they just bought stuff from the shop and mixed it together, and they had magic bombs out of it all, but they weren't really sure what the substances actually were, and they're still not really sure what the actual chemical substances of these supposed bombs were. In the first official narrative that came out, that was written anonymously by the Home Office, which was only like maybe 60, not even that, pages long, really short. It said expert examination continues. And that came out in 2006. I mean, what further examination of these chemicals or whatever do they really need to do? I did some research and it said all they have to do is, this expert in one of the American newspapers said, all they have to do is swab some surfaces and then they can find out what it was within a few hours. So it's kind of confusing. CCTV has now come out showing them buying things from B&Q, which is a British hardware store, with all this kind of, you know, stuff in. And the main theory they're going with now is that they used a peroxide mix with black pepper or, you know, this pepper stuff. But it's not really clear how they know that, because they've never come forth actually saying they have the chemical makeup of the bombs. Another important point is that no postmortems were done on the victims, no internal postmortems. So there's no data in regard to how the blasts actually affected the bodies. I mean, they know that it blew people up, but you know, you think if they did tests, it would somewhat indicate the type of explosive, you know, the type of burns, its impact, and the characteristics of the bomb. Instead, what they did is they made it all up using computer models. And, you know, the old saying, crap in, crap out, if they don't know the details, then the model isn't going to magically get it right. And it's just really, really, really confusing. In my film, 77 The Big Picture, I have quotes from the days after the attacks of explosive experts, forensic scientists, police, intelligence officials, all across the board, all on record to the media soon after the attacks, testifying that high-grade, possibly military explosives were used. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner said the bombs certainly were not homemade. Leading British explosives expert Hans Michels said the perpetrators acquired either military or high quality commercial explosives, possibly from the Middle East. The Times were told that traces of military plastic explosive, more sophisticated than homemade bombs, were believed to have been found. There were even reports, there's a good book by a gentleman named Nafis Ahmed, and in there he explains how some officials were even flying off to different countries trying to track down the origins of these bombs. So all of a sudden, after all that, it's now peroxide and some this black pepper stuff. It's a huge contradiction.
Absolutely. Yet another absolutely fundamental part of the entire investigation, which has not really been resolved after all these years, just really incomprehensible unless we see that there is an actual obfuscation of the truth going on here rather than investigation into it. But you mentioned your 77 The Big Picture documentary, which of course is available for free viewing on wideshut.co.uk. And it's a rather formidable work. I guess it's over 4 hours in running length. Just an incredibly comprehensive, wide spectrum overview of the attacks and the history and the context of false flag terrorism. Tell people a little bit about that documentary and how and when and why you came to work on it and how it developed.
Yeah, well, when the 7/7 attacks happened themselves, I was only 15 years old, so it kind of bypassed me. You know, I wasn't really subjected to that media programming because I just wasn't interested. You know, I didn't care about Al-Qaeda and all that rubbish. I was too busy playing the PlayStation or whatever. So as I sort of began to get into these subjects now, the logical thing to me was to go back and really take a look at what happened without the media programming programming being there. And because 9/11 is such a focus in the wider truth community, and 7/7 in many ways was sort of Britain's 9/11 on a much smaller scale in terms of repercussions, you know, draconian terror laws, the promotion of the war on terror and the wars overseas and stuff, it was very similar. So I thought, you know, it's worth going back to day one and retracing what happened. And it soon became clear that the official narrative was just speculative at best and completely full of holes and just wrong, you know, at worst. And I then discovered the great July7th.co.uk website, which is everyone should go there and just read through it. It's practically a database of anomalies and important questions that need answering. And, you know, I kind of always wanted to do a documentary, so I just went and did it, you know. I think maybe the length maybe is a problem, and that in the Redux I'm going to be shortening it, because although it covers every kind of aspect of the war on terror, your great film Al Qaeda Doesn't Exist was a big inspiration for the Al Qaeda part of that film. But, you know, I've kind of, it's so big, it might lose its impact on the average person. So I'm going to sort of redo it with all the information from the inquest and try and get a real shorter, powerful film that you could give to the man on the street and sort of wake them up to all of this.
Well, I'm incredibly honored to hear that that I had any part in helping to inspire or to help that documentary, because, of course, Al Qaeda Doesn't Exist is really only the prologue and part one of what was envisioned to be a 7-part documentary, and it's still coming one of these years, I'm sure, if I ever get the chance to actually work on it. So absolutely, it's great to see that that feeds other researchers out there as well. So it is one big virtuous circle, and the alternative media is just so important in helping to spread awareness of these issues, which of course are not going to go reported on by the BBC or any other sort of big mainstream media news outlet. So tell us a little bit about Wide Shut and some of the issues it's focusing on and the origin behind it.
Well, Wide Shut is, you know, I was a well, I still am, you know, a big supporter of the whole InfoWars thing. And I saw how that's taken off in America and how, you know, a lot of UK readers are on the InfoWars site. And but at the same time, it is very US centric. And I thought we need something like that in the UK that can analyze the big important events, but can also talk about what our parliament is doing, what you know, what our prime minister is or isn't doing, our Bank of England, you know, not just the Federal Reserve. So I kind of developed that, I think 2 years ago, to be honest, I can't even remember. But, it, you know, started with a few blog posts, gradually built up until now, where I basically try and cover at least one of the major stories each week. I also have a YouTube channel where I do videos, actually, again, inspired by your great Corbett reports, the sort of more straight-laced news kind of thing. I've just started doing that on my show. It's called on my channel, it's called the Wide Shut Webcast, where I kind of do, again, from a sort of UK perspective on things. So it's just trying to wake people up in my neck of the woods, really.
And having quite an effect, yes. I recommend for people who haven't watched the Wide Shut webcast yet that they do so. And what's the YouTube channel name again?
It's youtube.com/WideShutUK.
Right, exactly. youtube.com/WideShutUK. And I certainly hope people will go to check that out. And of course, you're also on Twitter and Facebook, and all of that is linked from WideShut.co.uk. All right, well, Keelan, wrapping up this conversation and talking about 7/7 and the inquests and everything that's been developing, what do you expect from this point? What do you think is likely to play out from these inquests and any possible future investigations?
It's kind of tough to analyze. I mean, what can we do? For me, it's about education on a non-official level, on a people level, because our government over here have proven time and time again that they can't be trusted, that they're not transparent in what they do. You know, they're willing to invade foreign countries based on lies. They're willing to allow the economy to crash. So turning to the government to investigate is in a way legitimizing that government. If they're not going to help us, which they've shown that they're not going to, then we're going to have to come to our own educated conclusions and just bypass them. I mean, in many ways, they are the ones that need investigating. And for me, 7-7 is, it's part of the bigger problem in this country and in the world. You know, the Afghanistan problem, the complete collapse of the banking system, the Big Brother state, the EU even. It's part of a long list of problems that we need to face. And I think if we're not getting answers from the government that we deserve as citizens, then maybe we need to start joining the student protests that are happening over here, joining the austerity protests that are beginning to happen over here, and make it clear that if they're not going to start listening to the people and doing what's right for the country, then maybe like Egypt or something, it's not really beyond the realm to force the government out.
Absolutely. Well, that's exactly the impetus behind the corporate report. We have to start building up the alternative to the mainstream media and becoming that media to inform people of the real issues, because I think for decades now we've gone to sleep and allowed the mainstream media to tell us about reality. And unfortunately, we see what has transpired because of all that, including things like 7-7. So it's so important that that people out there take the responsibility on themselves to start spreading this information, because no one's going to spread it for you. So you might as well be energized and empowered by the technology that we have while we have access to it. So that's why I'm excited to see things like wideshut.co.uk and all the other alternative media outlets that are out there working to make a difference. And again, I think it's not one of us, but all of us together that's going to have an effect and really affect the societal discourse that's going on. So I guess you are working on the Big Picture Redux. Do you have a time frame on when that might be available?
My ultimate time frame, because I said for 7-7 the Big Picture I'd get it out bang on the 5th year anniversary, and it kind of went a few months after that. I am actually working on two other films as well. One's called Who Owns Britain, and it's kind of investigating the economic collapse, the Bank of England, who owns our debt, things like that. I'm also working on another documentary on the bare basics of the New World Order agenda and, you know, why we do argue against the New World Order, why it does exist, and you know, just the bare bone facts, not too speculative, just, you know, trying to get that out there. So I'm working on three things, and my aim is to get it all done by 2012, but I don't have a date for any specific film.
Excellent. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to that, and I certainly hope that you can continue to come on the Corbett Report as a guest in the future and keep us updated on your work.
Absolutely.
Excellent. All right. Well, Keelan Balderson, wideshut.co.uk, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
No problem. It was an honor.